Today is September 6, 2013. I welcome you to this study as we embark upon it this Friday evening, just after sunset in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, Eastern Standard Time. The title of our study I will announce as we advance. We've given a lot of focus and study to the women of Revelation, the woman of Revelation 12, and the woman of Revelation 17. We show that they both grow out of the same church wilderness experience. And the reason why we have seemingly belabored the focus of this is because attached to it are so many lessons from the Bible that relate and give us understanding. We show that they're both prefigurative of Eve because Eve is prefigurative of the Lord's ministry, the one that is predisposed to feed. And indeed, both women feed. We've shown that in her shepherding, she relates to Peter, because Peter was the one that was given the commission to feed the Lord's sheep. And tied up with those themes are a lot of other sub-themes and subplots that give us a greater clarity and a greater understanding. My thoughts today take us to Mark chapter 14, verse 29 and 30. But Peter said unto him, although all shall be offended, yet will not I. We see here now that Peter swears himself before the Lord and before the disciples to be a proponent of Christianity, full of a world of people that are antagonistic towards the Lord and His gospel. Peter says, you can count on me, Lord. I'm with you. To use a colloquialism, people like Peter talk jive. They just don't know that they're talking jive. They may be sincere to the utmost. And as a result, when the Lord countermands their statements with a straight testimony, they're predisposed to become offended. Well, Peter did not do so because of the stature and the acclaim of the Lord. But let a servant of the Lord put them straight. Then you will see how quickly they become offended. Well, how dare you? You don't know me. Problem is, you don't know you either. You need to have a greater insight into how the human mind works. We see witness of this in verse 30. And Jesus said unto him, verily I say unto thee, that this day, even in this night, before the cock crow twice, thou shalt deny me thrice. Several important points we can focus on from that text. But before we do so, the title of my study is Cock-a-doodle-doo. We see that Peter's denial was to take place in the night. A little bit of backdrop here. This text in the Gospels with which it is recorded, Mark 14, Matthew 26, Luke 22, it is cased in a time slot at the end of the Lord's ministry. But more important to us today, it takes place after the communion service. After the communion, after the Lord informed them about the need to wash their feet, the need to drink of His blood and eat of His flesh, the symbolism of the wine and the bread thereto pertaining, He took a trip to the Mount of Olives. That suggests to you that beforehand, because when you journey to a mountain, you go from low to high, right? That means that He began to cause His disciples to ascend. Matthew chapter 26, it gives us a very special insight into this ascension, one that the other two gospel writers do not record. They don't contradict, but they don't record. It shows that he took three disciples, the sons of Zebedee and Peter, and they ascended with him. But something disconcerting occurred. They all fell into a deep, disorienting sleep. For it says, neither wist they what to answer. I'm extracting that phrase from verse 40. But again, in the context, it shows you that the Lord, after prayer, came to awaken them. And when it says, neither wist they what to answer, we can all relate to that. You've been woken up and your sleep has been so good that you're completely disoriented and your mind can't even filter in the messages that are being directed towards you. We see from this lesson that it's an experience of the Christian church. And let me just interrupt myself here to give you some application and some understanding. We need not become confused to think that the lessons are comprehensive. What do I mean by that? Because the Lord sent his disciples to meet with the man bearing the pitcher of water, and because we garner a lesson that's important for us today pertaining to the communion that took place in the upper room, showing that that was an experience that was applicable to the end time disciples today, it does not mean that the lesson cannot break and give a different meaning as we advance. This trip to the Mount of Olives shows the excursion of the Christian church over the past 2,000 years. All of the disciples, in other words, all of those who identified themselves as Christian, did not experience the elevation. The three that went make reference to the ones that had special closeness and communion to the Lord, representing his appointed church. That should give us a new insight, because now we understand that the Lord had management over all of Christianity. But then he identifies through this experience the work of the Adventist ministry. They have received a higher ascension, a higher calling. Sadly enough, though, they can't boast for that because they find themselves all in a deep slumber. They find themselves in disharmony with the Lord's purpose. He wanted them to watch and pray, and they wanted to do something else. They wanted to sleep. But beforehand, he gave to them this promise of the crowing of the cock, that this day, even in this night, before the cock crow twice, thou shalt deny me thrice. What does that mean? What lesson in Christianity can we extrapolate from that? Let us seek to refine that lesson with this very study. In preparation for this study, I felt the need to do a little bit of research. You know, the cock or the rooster makes a multi-syllabic note, which is universally recognized. That's why I've entitled it Cock a Doodle Doo. It's not like a trumpet where it just has a consistent sound. This is a complicated note, but miraculously, it's one that's universally understood. I had made that assumption, but I had to do some research. I know enough to know that the roosters in the West sound the same, though the people do not, as the roosters in the East of the United States, in the South, and in the West. But I had to wonder, does a Chinese rooster cock in Chinese? And does a Filipino rooster give us a different outcry? So I checked with Brother Jose. He's been to a different land where they speak a different language. And I asked him, in Puerto Rico, do the cocks crow the same way as they do in the United States? And he confirmed my suspicion. Yes, they do. How consequently we know the brilliance of the Lord. He found for us and isolated for us a sound that is universally familiar in all lands. Your chicken is a very popular bird. And throughout every age, that forces us to search, to uncover its proverbial meaning. And having said that, let me just remind everybody that the Lord, when he made his declarations, spoke in proverb. Did not he affirm as much? He said, and I quote, in John chapter 16, verse 25, these things have I spoken unto you in proverbs, but the time cometh when I shall no more speak unto you in proverbs, but shall show you plainly of the Father. As a result, because we trust our salvation in the testimony of Jesus, we have to attribute this lesson of the crowing of the cock to be not just a literal rendition, but a proverbial rendition. One that needs to be made plain today. And this we need to understand because we recognize that all of the Lord's words that he spoke, and I could cite to you over and over again the scriptures that affirm this, I challenge you to, in your quiet time, search them out if you have doubt. But the words that the Lord spoke represents statements that Christ revealed through Jesus' tongue and lips, commanding Jesus what to say. And they represent words that the Father instructed Christ to deliver to us. In fact, let's not leave that unproven. John chapter 12, verse 47 through 50. And if any man hear my words, now you know what we've defined as hearing his words in our prior study. He pointed to the cup of wine at communion and said, this is the New Testament. That represents the words that he spoke. If any man hear my words and believe not, I judge him not, for I came not to judge the world, but to save the world. He that rejecteth me and receiveth not my words hath one that judgeth him. The words that I have spoken, the same shall judge him in the last day. For I have not spoken of myself, but the Father. I emphasize but the Father because the text that we read in John chapter 16, verse 25 says, but I shall show you plainly of the Father. To show us plainly, we have to see the Father's communion. And he says, for I have not spoken of myself, but the Father which sent me, he gave me a commandment, what I should say and what I should speak. And I know that his commandment is life everlasting. Whatsoever I speak, therefore, even as the Father saith unto me, so I speak. That's John chapter 12, verse 47 through 50 that I just read to you. And therefore, it's incumbent upon us to seek out the meaning that the Lord may reveal to us the Father, that we may be able to take his testimony that was before cited proverbially and garner meaning from it. I point you back to the episode on the Mount of Olives, the three disciples sleeping. Let us read verses 37 and 38 of Mark 14. And he cometh and findeth them sleeping, and said unto Peter, Simon, sleepest thou? Couldest not thou watch 1 hour? Watch ye and pray, lest ye enter into temptation. The spirit truly is ready, but the flesh is weak. I want you to gain an understanding here that's special, at least it's special to me. Because Simon Peter, had he not have so much high regard and respect for the Lord, would have perhaps replied, why do I always get the blame? We're all sleeping. You isolate me and put the blame on me. And beyond that, you don't understand why I sleep. I sleep in because I'm tired. But Simon, I need for you to watch and pray. Lest ye enter into temptation. I don't want you to succumb to the power of the devil, Simon. Your spirit is willing. It's ready. But your flesh is weak. That shows Simon being prefigurative of the Lord's end time shepherd. Understand, when I say shepherd, that covers the expanse of the Christian experience. We've all been given as Christians the duty and responsibility to feed God's sheep. The Lord took three disciples. They all fell asleep, but one was rebuked. The one that was supposed to not fall into temptation. The one that was supposed to strengthen the brethren. That was Peter. A Peter has to be representative of his last day shepherd. Those who embrace the shepherd's rod message have fallen asleep. And this message is prefigurative of them. They represent the highest. He could have likewise rebuked the sons of Zebedee. I believe James and John. But the same lesson would not have prevailed. And remember, this is proverbial speech. We need to gain plain meaning from it. Davidia, I understand that Laodicea is asleep. But could not you stay awake? Could not you watch and pray? You're in danger of falling into temptation. You're not spiritual, you're fleshy. The spirit is ready, but the flesh is weak. That sounds like a cliche that we had drilled in our minds, but it has quite the impact. Because our commission is to walk by the Spirit and not by the flesh. You know what Paul tells you in Romans chapter 8? Paul tells you that the righteousness of the law might be fulfilled in us. Wow. You want the righteousness of the law? There's good things about the law, despite what you've heard in the Christian community. They're asleep. That the righteousness of the law might be fulfilled in us who walk not after the flesh, but after the Spirit. For they that are after the flesh do mind the things of the flesh, but they that are after the Spirit, the things of the Spirit. For to be carnally minded is death, but to be spiritually minded is life and peace. For the carnal mind is enmity against God, for it is not subject to the law, neither indeed it can be. As a result, now we have a definition by connecting that verse with what we just read in John chapter 12, because it shows you that to be carnally minded is to ignore the Lord's words. Because the Father gave the Lord His words, and the Lord was careful to articulate them, because they represented life everlasting. That's the benefit, Peter, of not falling asleep. I hope you understand that as we advance, we can take snippets of the Lord's testimony and make special meaning out of them. And this is what we're seeing again tonight. Mark chapter 14, verse 37 and 38, the text that we just read, speaks to Peter's central commission to lead the disciples. The flesh being weak, it manifests and explains the church's apostasy. Her brain is wired. That's what the flesh is. It's wired to succumb to temptation. This is why the devil was so bold to deceive his angels that he could win this controversy. He knew that your mind was predisposed to turn against God. He didn't understand that you have been given power to control your mind. And that's why in the darkest of night, when sleep is irresistible, you have to gain, speaking metaphorically, the power to overcome the flesh. You have to become trained. Don't say that this is impossible. I watched my wife for 25 years work nights in a hospital. I've been driving on long excursions at 1 o'clock, I couldn't contain myself. I had to pull over and let her take over. 300 more miles to go, honey. Well, I'm awake. I can take over. Her mind was trained to be awake at night. And before I knew it, I'd wake up and she'd be pulling in the garage. If secular humanity can learn this principle, then we know that Father expects those who've ascended the highest to master it as well. From this text, we can peer into it more deeply and see Peter's duty as a shepherd. And you're not going to understand fully the woman of Revelation 12. I don't care how many charts you have. You're not going to be able to understand the woman of Revelation 17 unless you understand that the messages delivered to Peter spoke to his duty as a divinely inspired and appointed shepherd. One who has taken 2,000 years. Well, Peter passed and is gone. How sayest thou 2,000 years? I'm speaking to Peter being used as an icon to represent the last day message. For he took that period of time to become converted. Let's look into that a little more carefully. Let us see if we can discern from the scripture that Peter, as a literal man who walked with the Lord 2,000 years ago, was intended to represent for us an icon, an ensample, a type for the house of David, the son of David and his work. We can begin by turning to Matthew chapter 16. Let's take a little bit of time and carefully peruse this. We're going to read verses 13 through 19, but before we are through, we're going to finish by reading verses 20 through 23. And when Jesus came into the coast of Caesarea Philippi, he asked his disciples, saying, "Whom do men say that I, the Son of Man, am?" And they said, "Some say that thou art John the Baptist, some Elias, others Jeremias, or one of the other prophets." Pausing from verse 14 of John chapter 16, we can immediately see that the church, the highest organization on the land to represent the Lord, was completely ignorant about Christ. They had studied for that time 1,500 years pertaining to his arrival, but when he came, they were completely ignorant. This speaks to the disciples falling asleep in the dark of night. None understood the identity of Christ. He mentioned this in several places. I believe one is Luke chapter 10, the other is Matthew chapter 11. "No man knoweth who the Son is but the Father, and who the Father is but the Son, and he to whom the Son will reveal." And now we have our answer. Well, who is it that the Father will reveal the identity of the Son? We have that by looking to Peter as an icon. Because the Lord said in verse 15, "But whom say ye that I am?" And Simon Peter answered and said, "Thou art the Christ, the Son of the living God." Now, Peter may not have understood what he was saying, but his words were profound and need to be carefully examined. He announced that Jesus was the Christ, which could only mean that he was the prophet like unto Moses, the one through whom the God who communicated to his people from Sinai, Christ, was to communicate. Therefore, it would have been erroneous to say, "Thou art Christ." The devils, when they looked at Jesus, they tried out Christ by saying, "We know who you are. Thou art Christ." But Peter didn't say, he said, "Thou art the Christ," which only can be understood today when you discern the distinction between Jesus and Christ, because the Christ is the one that represented Christ's voice to the people as he hid by promise and by covenant upon the prophet like unto Moses, who was Jesus, and spoke through him. So the Christ is a title. Christ is a name. Jesus deserved the title The Christ. And by virtue of that pronouncement, as we read in verse 17, because he further said, you're not God, you're the Son of God. The Adventist Church, we uncovered this week by speaking to some of its members, or one of its members, still believes that Jesus was God. Peter doused that belief. You're not God, you're the Son of God. And because of that pronouncement, he didn't receive a curse, he received a blessing. Blessed art thou, Simon Bar-Jonah, for flesh and blood hath not revealed it unto thee, but the Father which is in heaven. Now we can see how we can connect what we read, but no man knoweth who the Son is, but the one to whom the Son will reveal. That has to be referenced to antitypical Peter. This text tells us that he receives his gospel directly from the Father. Verse 17, again, chapter 16, it says, for flesh and blood hath not revealed it unto thee, but my Father which is in heaven. And I say also unto thee, that thou art Peter, and upon this rock will I build my church, and the gates of hell shall not prevail against it. We have the clue now. We've turned to this text merely to show you that Peter was prefigurative of the end time gospel. We know that the gates of hell have kicked the church from pillar to post for the last 2,000 years. They've received nothing but sorrow, pain, and death. For the gates of hell to not prevail, therefore, we need to know what we've learned in Romans chapter 8, you have to walk by the Spirit and not by the flesh. We've learned in Mark chapter 14, you have to overcome the temptation to sleep. We've learned, likewise, from John chapter 12, that we have to receive the words that the Father commanded Christ to speak. For those words represent everlasting life. Victory over the gates of hell means you have to have victory over the grave. Because it was the sinister deceptions of Satan in the garden that delivered to you the destiny of death. Peter has long since passed away and gone. The text can only be true if Peter was given to us proverbially to represent the end time ministry, the man whom the Lord promised to raise up in the last day. But he doesn't stop there. He says, And I will give unto thee the keys of the kingdom of heaven. And whatsoever thou shalt bind on earth shall be bound in heaven. And whatsoever thou shalt loose on earth shall be loosed in heaven. This means a great deal to us, but first and foremost, let's consider it in terms of judgment. If you want salvation, that has to be registered in the books of heaven for the judgment of the living. You have to come to Peter and allow him to unlock to you the door, which represents Christ, that you can garner entry into the sheepfold. That's how you gain membership in the kingdom. That's what it means to have the keys of the kingdom. The keys of the kingdom let people in, and the keys of the kingdom lock people out. Peter, not V.T. Hotef, not E.G. White, but somebody with the gospel of everlasting life. Somebody who's never seen the grave. Somebody, and let me put a qualifier on this now, somebody defined as triumphant Peter, not sleepy-eyed Peter, is going to have the keys of the kingdom that's going to bind in heaven or have his verdicts fortified and certified in heaven, which means that he receives what Paul refers to as the righteousness of the law. Because it's the law that separates you from God. And it's the law that binds you to the Lord. You need to understand how man is made at one with God. You need to understand the atonement for you to know how you receive salvation in heaven. How you become in harmony with God. Peter has the key. Let me remind you that literal, actual ancient Peter is dead. Therefore, he cannot bind anything. He cannot give you any victory over the gates of hell. some religions, I suspect the Catholic Church in particular, has made accommodations to this, and they have people believing that Peter stands by the gates. And therefore, they make an appeal to what they call St. Peter. And in a lot of their mythology, they seek to impress St. Peter because they think that he's going to let them into heaven. The faltering there is the misunderstanding and the failure to appreciate that the kingdom of heaven is established not in heaven, but on earth. It's the kingdom of heaven because it shows heaven's victory over Satan. It shows victory over the gates of hell. Believe it or not, you can receive life everlasting on planet earth and freedom from the onslaught of the devil while your feet walk the dusty paths of Jerusalem on planet earth. It only seems impossible because your mind is asleep to reality. Let's look at some testimony of Jesus accounts that give us reason for this. Luke chapter 13, verse 28 and 29. We've left Matthew chapter 16. We were reading verse 13 through 19. We're going to revisit verse 20 through 23. But en route to that, we find ourselves in Luke chapter 13. We're trying to establish that Peter is an icon, that he has the keys of the kingdom, and that he allows people entry into the kingdom of heaven as it is established on earth. Earth was made for the saints. Verse 28, there shall be weeping and gnashing of teeth when ye shall see Abraham and Isaac and Jacob and all the prophets in the kingdom of God, and you yourselves thrust out. Verse 29, and they shall come from the east and from the west and from the north and from the south and shall sit down in the kingdom of God. That's Luke chapter 13, verse 28 and 29. From that we see the day is going to come of resurrection where the patriarchs and the prophets are going to be placed in the kingdom. And then people that do not need resurrected are going to come from the four corners of the globe. That's the only way that you could discuss a kingdom in terms of the north, the south, and the east, and the west. They come from all those directions to the point where Jesus was communing with them. A place close to Jerusalem in Palestine. And promising that the day was going to come when there's going to be a gathering in that location. Whereby the people are going to come, the redeemed. And they are going to garner entry into the kingdom. They're not going to ascend up. Let's not add to the Lord's words. These are Father's proverbial speech. Made plain, they're going to sit down. That means they're going to be at rest and at peace. They're going to be seated in the kingdom. And they're only going to do so because Peter is given the keys. Because Peter's been given victory over the gates of hell. Because Peter has defined the identity of the Lord. What does that have to do with the cock crowing twice? Well, let's advance towards that. We're not through in our excursion. We need to really examine Matthew chapter 25, verse 31 and 34. When the Son of Man shall come in his glory, and all the holy angels with him, then shall he sit upon the throne of his glory. He comes back. The Lord returns back from heaven to earth. And he comes with all the holy angels. And before him shall be gathered all nations, and he shall separate them one from another, as a shepherd divideth his sheep from the goats. And he shall set the sheep on his right hand, but the goats on the left. Somebody else is brought into the picture now. Then shall the king say unto them on his right hand, come ye blessed of my Father. That king could only be prefigurative of Peter. Because he invites people to garner entry. Imagine if he represented someone other than Peter, and they came to the gates of Palestine, of the kingdom, to commune with the Son of Man, the Lord. And they were denied entry because Peter said no. The only way that they could be invited to the kingdom is if the person who invited them had the keys to the kingdom. That king is not representative of Jesus, not representative of Christ, is representative of the icon that the Lord left on record for us, Peter. I use that term, icon. It's a fancy term for us today. It's one that we're not used to hearing from yesterday's gospel because they did not have really the full benefit of that. That word has wormed its way into our communications because this is the computer age. But it's just as good as saying the antitype, isn't it? I think so. We can't finish this discussion about the kingdom until we discern that it is described as a grain of mustard seed. The kingdom of heaven is likened to a grain of mustard seed, we're told in Matthew chapter 13, which shows you not only that it represents Peter, but it represents a man and his wife. For the mustard seed to germinate, it needs to have a male and female cell placed therein. And it grows so that the birds of the air lodge in its branches. It has branches, and it provides lodging for the birds of the air. That's why it's made comparable to the kingdom. Peter, therefore, is prefigurative of the mustard seed. Therefore, as we learn of the emergence of this symbol that the Lord represented to us, proverbially, as Peter, we're going to learn of Christ differently. Let me read to you a note, one that has quickly become one of my favorite references from the spirit of prophecy. When the light goes forth to lighten the earth, interrupting that prophecy, the spirit of prophecy and testimonies of minister under the pen of E.G. White, page 300, begins the reference by saying, when the light goes forth to lighten the earth, what does that remind you of? The sunrise, doesn't it? That's a special day. Aren't you able to see things differently in the light than you saw them in the darkness? Isn't that a common experience that we have on planet Earth? Well, when that happens, when light goes forth to lighten the earth, instead of coming up to the help of the Lord, they will want to bind about his work to meet their narrow ideas. Let me tell you that the Lord will work in this last work in a manner very much out of the common order of things, and in a way that will be contrary to any human planning. There will be those amongst us who will always want to control the work of God, to dictate even what movements shall be made when the work goes forward under the direction of the angel who joins the third angel in the message to be given to the world. God will use ways and means by which it will be seen that he has taken the reins in his own hands. Before sunrise, that situation didn't prevail because she says it's only going to occur at sunrise. As a result, when it occurs, you can't reference your understanding as it existed under a different administration before Christ took the reins in his own hands. I have to refer you to John chapter 13 as we focus a little more intently on this idea that Peter prefigures the end-time prophet, the prophet like unto Moses. Verses 6 through 9, speaking of that same communion service that we introduced this study with, it tells us, then cometh he to Simon Peter, and Peter saith unto him, Lord, dost thou wash my feet? And Jesus answered and said unto him, what I do thou knowest not now, but thou shalt know hereafter. And Peter said unto him, thou shalt never wash my feet. And Jesus answered him, if I wash thee not, thou hast no part with me. Peter said, pertaining to the Lord's communion efforts, that I will not accept you to clean me. The Lord says, you don't understand the meaning of this. But you're going to understand one day. Those words we now know are made personal, not to the entirety of the disciples only, but specifically to Peter. We know from reading the scriptures that Peter never unfolded to us a different rendering of the communion service. It's only the mustard seed that has shown this to us. And it manifests that rebellious Peter, let's call him militant Peter, the same icon, does not want to remove his socks and shoes. He finds security in hiding his deeds from yesterday. He doesn't realize and understand that he'll never have peace. Because when the Lord washes his feet, the Lord justifies him. He brings him into harmony with the law. He shows him the things that he was ashamed of, though they may have been offensive to people and to humanity, they are not crimes and sins. Therefore, by you continually hiding those things, you're expressing a different formula for salvation. As a result, Peter, if I wash thee not, you have no part with me. Which goes to show you, in Matthew chapter 25, when it refers to the Son of Man coming with all his angels, and the king making a pronouncement, it shows you Christ in partnership with Peter. He promised, as I refer to Deuteronomy 18, that he will not speak to them directly, but through a prophet like unto Moses. That was part of the covenant law. That's part of the righteousness of the law that's going to be fulfilled in us. Thus, you have two dimensions of Peter. You have the dimension that refuses the communion service, refuses to acknowledge the authority of the Lord, measures him by yesterday's standards as being too dignified to commune with them. He refuses the Lord. That blossoms into the woman of Revelation 17, the whore. She too, you know, emerges, as the text says, from the wilderness. How did she get into the wilderness? She got into the wilderness because she left Palestine. And a place was prepared for her in the wilderness. When you see the woman in Revelation 12 and the woman in Revelation 17, both emerged in the place that was prepared to nourish the woman. The United States of America, as it advanced from the first place, Roman Europe. Peter was told, you shall know hereafter. Therefore, if you want to identify Peter, you need to find the person that unfolds to you the meaning of the foot-washing experience. But if we reflect back on our opening text in Mark chapter 14, when we saw that Peter was asleep, we can see from that the reason why Peter needs to be awakened. He needs to be awakened and alert so that he doesn't fall into temptation, so that he can discern the meaning that the Lord promised that he will receive hereafter. The question might be asked by some, how is it that we have so many metaphors? I told you that we need to examine the comprehension of the communion service. Some lessons pertain to the end time disciples, known as the mustard seed. Some pertain to the church and its excursion over the last 2,000 years, because both claim to follow the Lord. Thus, we see when we discuss the communion service, it began by the Lord sending the three disciples, Peter amongst them, to find the man bearing the pitcher of water. You find that in Matthew chapter 26, verse 18. And he said, go into the city to such a man, and say unto him, the master saith, my time is at hand. I will keep the Passover at thy house with my disciples. This is the man who bears the pitcher of water, as you read the full context and as it will express to you. The Lord says that he's going to keep the Passover at this man's house. The disciples are sent to find this man. He's bearing a pitcher of water, and it's at his house. Therefore, the man, by virtue of the symbolism of having your feet washed, has to reference the person who has the keys of the kingdom, has to represent antitypical Peter, has to represent the man that Peter prefigured proverbially. How then could the man bearing the pitcher of water be in the same scenario as Peter himself? In other words, Peter's feet are washed by the Lord with the pitcher of water. This man wasn't one of the Lord's disciples. As Matthew chapter 16 manifests, he is the one that the Father inspired. And as a result of the Father's inspiration, he is given the keys of the kingdom. He is given the power to bind on earth what is bound in heaven. He's given the power to authorize you to have membership in the kingdom. As a result, it's important to understand it's his house. How do you get in his house? By unlocking the door with the key. To gain membership and to pass the communion means you have salvation with everlasting life in the kingdom. Yet Peter's feet were washed. This shows you the depth of our study, because it makes you understand the split in Peter's personality. And to look at that more carefully, we have to finish reading Matthew chapter 16. Remember, we showed the blessing of Peter. Blessed art thou, Simon Barjona, in verse 17. For flesh and blood hath not revealed it unto thee, but my Father which is in heaven. And I will give unto thee the keys of the kingdom. Verse 19. Now let's read verse 20 through 23 of Matthew chapter 16. Then charged he his disciples that they should tell no man that he was Jesus the Christ. That has special meaning to us now, that those words, doesn't it? From that time forth began Jesus to show unto his disciples how that he must go unto Jerusalem. The church is resistant even to that, isn't it? No, I don't want to go to Jerusalem. Far be it from thee. I want to ascend up to heaven. He must go into Jerusalem and suffer many things of the elders and chief priests and scribes and be killed. Not only does he go to Jerusalem, but he doesn't win popularity in the church. The leadership of the church is out to destroy his ministry. That's a different concept than I first joined you with, Lord, with Peter speaking. I thought that we were going to call these people together, we were going to overthrow the Roman Empire, and we were going to find recognition by that august assembly of people whom I've learned to respect, the leadership. And it's a shock to me that you're telling me that you're going to go in a different path than that which they approve. I like your power, Lord. I like your gospel. I like your connection to heaven, Lord. But I don't like the fact that you're diverging from the things of the world. This is Peter talking. Then Peter took him and began to rebuke him, saying, Be it far from thee, Lord. This shall not be unto thee. But he turned and said unto Peter, Get thee behind me, Satan. Thou art an offense unto me, for thou savorest not the things that be of God, but those that be of men. Which goes to show you that Peter's great dilemma is going to be manifest in the conflict between being popular and following the Lord. He's going to have a struggle by savoring the things of men, which is Satan's domain. Why? Because Satan controls men. Doesn't matter whether he engenders the deception or they do, because he outranks them. He knows that he controls them. He can always argue that you belong to him as long as you savor the things of men. Therefore, the man bearing the pitcher of water represents triumphant Peter. Peter that is converted, and the one at communion who denies the Lord participation in his life represents rebellious Peter. A split in his personality. When the Lord promised him that you shall understand these things hereafter, he's telling you, therefore, you have to appreciate the symbolism that the Peter that's going to gain victory is going to understand these things. The Peter that resisted him was going to go to the grave. You don't want to be a part of the militant Peter who rebels against the Lord. You want to be a part of triumphant Peter. You want to pass through successfully the upper room experience. I have to point you to Jacob because he gives us a similar lesson, and that will reinforce what we've learned so that we can have a greater appreciation now of the consistency of this message. I'm reading Genesis chapter 32, verses 24 through 28. And Jacob was left alone. And there wrestled a man with him until the breaking of the day. See, that reminds me now of several things, particularly what we read in Testimonies of Ministers from E.G. White, page 300. When the light goes forth to lighten the earth. The man, Christ, did not wrestle with him through the morning. He wrestled with him only to the breaking of the day. And when he saw that he prevailed not against him, a marvel in itself. Means that he was wrestling for his heart. He was wrestling. The Lord wrestled with the disciples on the Mount of Olives, telling them to resist the struggle to sleep. And when he saw that he prevailed not against him, he touched the hollow of his thigh, and the hollow of Jacob's thigh was out of joint as he wrestled with him. That means one part of Jacob's leg was divergent from the other. That's the symbolism. Jacob split, and his personality was revealed. And he said, "Let me go, for the day breaketh." And he said, "I will not let thee go, except thou bless me." And he said unto him, "What is thy name?" And he said, "Jacob." And he said, "Thy name shall be called no more Jacob, but Israel. For as a prince hast thou power with God and with men, and hast prevailed." For Jacob to have power with God and men and to prevail means that he has to be given the kingdom of heaven. Means that what he binds on earth is bound in heaven. So we see that Jacob is an icon of the mustard seed as well. The fact of the matter that has been ignored all these years, the Lord says, "Thy name shall be no more called Jacob." He's no more a deceiver, a thief, and a supplanter. Remember the Lord tells you in John chapter 10, all that ever came before me were thieves and robbers. Well, Jacob was chief amongst them. Jacob no longer garners his sheep by stealing them. He garners them by righteousness. And by righteousness, he's no longer called Jacob. His name is changed to the overcomer, the prince. The one who has power with God and with man. Man says, "I want to be connected with God." Well, you got to hook up through Peter, Jacob, whose name was changed to Israel. You've heard the expression, "We have met the enemy, and the enemy is us." Well, that's true with Peter, Jacob. The Lord is depicting that their struggle is within themselves. There's the carnal side that wants to go to the grave, and there's the spiritual side that wants to walk eternally, and those two parties have to be separated. And I tell you that when you read the two women of Revelation, you see the path of separation. In Revelation chapter 18, the Lord shows you the reason why you should not admire the whore, because she's on a path of eternal destruction. It doesn't matter what you thought about her yesterday. If you're an eternal being and she is eternally lost, then her path will not be impressive tomorrow. And if you walk by faith, you will not live by what you see, by sight, but by promise. You will walk by the Spirit. You will know that perhaps 100 years from now, that woman, through all her pomp and praise, through all her wealth, is no longer in existence. She fell into the pit of deep and eternal humiliation and death. One more point as we seek to discern Peter and now Jacob as icons. The question is bound to emerge in your mind. Why do we need so many metaphors? So many icons? They all have different purposes, but you would think that just one would be enough. I mean, since the saints don't believe in Jacob typology, why teach them about Peter typology? Why another icon? I could list to you some of the icons. The ones that come to mind, you could probably think of some others. We read about Jacob. He symbolizes the mustard seed. We understood about Moses, about David, about Zerubbabel, about Elijah. They all symbolize the final work. Why give to us another? Isn't this a redundancy in scriptures? I beg your pardon. It's not a redundancy. Each icon shows different important meanings. But there's a special meaning in discerning iconic Peter. There's a special lesson in righteousness to learn by understanding that he is prefigurative of the end-time gospel proclaimer. He shows in reality the partnership with the Lord himself. We see that the Lord himself abode with him. The lessons that were delivered to him manifest the unity between the two. Likewise, Peter, unlike any of those others, heard the actual gospel commission. He heard the message of the kingdom. You know, when the Lord pronounced at the beginning of his ministry, "The kingdom of heaven is at hand," he was showing you that the testimony of Jesus was about to be unfolded. Well, Peter heard the entirety of the testimony of Jesus. Therefore, he's a specially important person for us to understand. We learn of the others so we can co-join them into the ultimate one, which is manifest in understanding the personality of Peter. Let's get a glimpse of that by turning to John chapter 17, reading verses 19 through 23. And for this sake I sanctify myself, that they also might be sanctified through the truth. What is the truth? Verse 17, sanctify them through thy truth. Thy word is truth. The Father's testimony that he delivered to Christ is the truth that sanctifies you. If you don't receive that, then you are asleep to the gospel, just as Peter was. And when he speaks and tries to awaken you, you are completely disoriented. You can't hear his words. That brings truth to you, doesn't it? That's why the Lord petitioned the Father to sanctify the disciples through the truth. He can only sanctify them through the truth by virtue of Peter, because Peter is the one that's given the keys. Salvation comes by understanding the testimony of Jesus. It wins for you everlasting life. That's what wins for you victory over the gates of hell. And Peter was given those keys of kingdom entry. Neither pray I for these alone, but for them also which shall believe on me through their word, that they all may be one, as thou, Father, art in me, and I in thee, that they also may be one in us, that the world may believe that thou hast sent me. The reason why the Lord wanted partnership, beginning with Peter, was so that he could save the world. Again, being redundant in the message, Peter was to unlock the kingdom to them. Show them that exactly what he pronounced in Matthew chapter 16, that Christ was the Son of the living God. And the glory which thou gavest me, I have given them, that they may be one, even as we are one. Now we see that gift. He promised to give it to Peter. And he says that he's not praying just for the 12, but those that are going to believe on Christ through his word, which means that they are the ones that are to be brought into unity. They are the ones that he gave the keys to the kingdom to, the ones that will believe on Christ through their word. You can't believe on Christ unless you're able to identify him, and Peter gives you that identity. I in them and thou in me. This is partnership. Verse 23. That they may be made perfect in one, that the world may know that thou hast sent me and hast loved them as thou hast loved me. From that text, John chapter 17, 19 through 23, it shows the key. Power, glory, unity, strength, and shepherding. All in that one text. It helps us to summarize the Lord's commission. But most especially, it shows to us the woman of Revelation 12. It shows her clothier with the sun, the shroud of the testimony of Jesus, Peter's strengthening of his brethren, the Lord's answered prayer. Remember he said, we read in Luke chapter 22, verse 31, it's likewise in the context of the communion service. Simon, Simon, behold, Satan hath desire to have you, but I have prayed for thee that thy faith fail not. And when thou art converted, strengthen thy brethren. It could have said, if you're not converted, your brethren are going to be strong. I'm going to turn to them. That's not what it said. Therefore, we finish this section here of this particular study, seeking to discern meaning of the cocks crow. But we finished it by seeing that Peter is represented to us as a symbol. Otherwise, how could he strengthen his brethren? He's dead. The Lord's prayer for Peter referred to those people in the last days that would believe on the Lord through their testimony. They are the ones that are to be given the keys of the kingdom. Therefore, as they unite with the mustard seed, they become one in purpose. And we see that they become manifestations of the icon of Peter themselves. Okay, let us now revisit Mark chapter 14. All things that the Lord spoke to us being proverbial, the crowing of the rooster. I don't know how to represent it to you. I don't have a rooster here. Except to say, cock-a-doodle-doo. You know that he sounds a multi-syllable message. It's not a simplistic message. It's more powerful than the sounding of a trumpet. It has several qualities and syllables to it, ones that are universally recognized. Mark chapter 14, verse 29 and 30. But Peter said unto him, although all shall be offended, yet will not I. And Jesus said unto him, verily I say unto thee, that this day, even this night, before the cock crow twice, thou shalt deny me thrice. Let us take pause now to garner the order of events. When the cock crows twice, Peter will have already finished his denial. He will have denied him thrice. The focus of this text is not on the first crowing of the cock. The Lord gives us no accounting of what's to happen after the first crowing. He just lets us know what will have happened. In language arts, they refer to that as future perfect. By the time the cock crows, you will have completed your denial of me. Let's turn to verses 69 through 72 of Mark chapter 14. And the maids saw him again and began to say to them that stood by, this is one of them. And he denied it again. That's the second denial. And a little after, they that stood by said again to Peter, surely thou art one of them, for thou art a Galilean, and thy speech agreeth thereto. But he began to curse and swear, saying, I know not this man of whom ye speak. And the second time the cock crew. And Peter called to mind the word that Jesus said unto him, before the cock crew twice, thou shalt deny me thrice. And when he thought thereon, he wept. All this is packed with meaning, present truth understanding that needs to be unfolded. We can see that Peter only is cognizant of his denial after the cock crows. That means when he denied him the first time, he didn't even understand what he was doing. When he denied him the second time, he didn't understand what he was doing. When he denied him the third time, he didn't understand what he was doing until the cock crowed. Else he would not have wept. He would not have remembered the testimony of Jesus that reached his heart. He became saddened. This is an expression of the highest saints on earth. They boast of being the shepherds of the Lord, which means they call to themselves the icon of Peter. But they are detached from the work. They haven't believed on the Lord through the testimony revealed by the original disciples. It represents Davidi's rejection, but more so than that, it's their rejection to mix Proverbs after the experience of the five wise and five foolish virgins. Remember, at midnight there was a cry. Now, we're not talking about midnight. At midnight, they discovered what? That they didn't have the extra oil. At midnight, they awakened. Then they sought the extra oil, and then they went to get it. And even before the sun rose, they sought entry. They didn't have the key. They were denied entry. So they wept and gnashed their teeth. Iconic Peter. By virtue of the fact that they received the testimony of Jesus means that they remembered the Lord's words to him. Something drew their minds back to the testimony of Jesus. And it was a powerful episode in their life. It was the crowing of the cock. They were rejected just before sunrise. Before reality hit them, they were so adamant to detach themselves from the mustard seed gospel, so determined to reject what the Lord had told them, to show the world that they had no connection, that they had no connection to the mustard seed. Remember, he who receiveth whom the Lord sent, receiveth me, and he that receiveth me, receiveth him that sent me. Therefore, their determination to fit in, to savor the things of men, to win on approval, because they were intimidated by the august presence of the people that rejected the Lord, they became real gutter, real vile. They began to curse and swear. This is what Davidia is going through right now. They are so determined to resist this light, but they don't realize tomorrow they're going to weep and it's going to be to no avail. They represent perpetual rebellious Peter. But I tell you that we need to understand the crowing of the cock. I tell you again that it represents a universal symbolism. Because the rooster, just as the Lord predicted, he said, this night, not this day, not after sunrise, this night, before the cock crows twice, you shall deny me thrice. The rooster crows to announce the sunrise, to alert everybody that a new day is about to dawn. And that's what the symbolism is designed to communicate to us. First he crows, then the sun rises. This is what Sister White said when she told us in Testimonies of Ministers, page 300, I refer to you again, when the light shall lighten the earth, things are going to be out of the common order of things. That's what the rooster's trying to tell you. You're used to the darkness. Get ready for the light. We could compare this to what we refer to as the lightning flash. It occurs while yet dark. Then the entirety of the world will know of Jacob's ordination, of the name change. There'll be no denying it. It's a day when Israel Peter is given divine power. Oh, you can argue with theology. You can debate over religion. You could deny the Lord thusly. But when you see people being resurrected from the dead, when you see people in mass numbers healed, when you see the lame made whole, when you see sickness cured, when you see mighty and marvelous miracles, you'll have no other option but to realize in that frozen moment of time that this is Emmanuel. God is with us. What you do afterwards, because as you get to work in the heat of the day, you forget, don't you, about the rooster that woke you up. But at least in that moment of time, you know exactly what you've sought after. You see divine relief and power. And Davidia will see this as well. And they will be converted, but too late. They will realize the mistakes and the errors of their way. Before that, Davidia, the Lord's ordained shepherds, had the audacity to wrestle Christ for his power. But the Lord is not going to eternally wrestle with them. He says, let me go, because the dawning of the day cometh, putting us in direct connection with the same expression that we see with the crowing of the cock. What was the first crowing of the cock? If the final crowing of the cock validates the testimony of Jesus, the identity of Jesus, and the power thereto pertaining, then the first crowing of the cock represents the same thing. This shows you the entire expanse of the Christian experience for 2,000 years. The first crowing of the cock represents the gospel as it was declared through the lips of Jesus. And what gives us a clue to this, as we bring the study to a close, is that we see, as Revelation 12 shows, the woman left Palestine clothed with the sun. That means she went through the experience of sunrise. Darkness prevailed afterwards, and we still wallow in that darkness. But the Lord promises that the cock is going to crow again. The testimony of Jesus is going to be redeclared and the gospel ministry will again be clothed with the testimony of the Lord. It will manifest the dawn of a new day. We could speak again to what we learned in Genesis chapter 32, what we've learned in Mark chapter 14. We just understand now that that experience of Jacob, that peniel power that he received, that power with God and with man, means that if you want to hook up, you have to come to Peter, the man with the key. He's able to wash, to justify, to advocate for the sheep. Where our minds are so dominated with tradition, we're so trapped in our sleep that Satan thought he had eternally locked us into his kingdom. Because he's imposed upon us not the righteousness of the law, but other human standards. And Peter is the one. You come to him, he'll wash your standards away. He'll justify the path that you walked. He'll tell you that the Lord, though the world may reject you, that the Father has made provisions to receive you. Come, you blessed of my Father, inherit the kingdom. That's why Peter is given the power to wash. That's why he's given the fountain. He's an advocate for the sheep. He legally makes their case and avoids them falling into temptation and to the mistaken notion that Christ will fail them. If their flesh is weak, they have a remedy, Peter's power with the keys. It is to strengthen them. It is to awaken them. And with that, I bring the study to a close.